Welcome to the Fearless Sellers, the Women of Amazon podcast. I'm Joey Roberts.
Okay, I go through all the things. That's when I had to figure out before pivoting those two brands, I was like going on these walks and just kind of being like, I'm screwed. Okay. Then it was just, you kind of like hit that reality of like, what am I going to do? I can't launch any more things in Europe. And then it's just kind of like, it's just kind of that process of hitting that rock bottom and then realizing, well, no one's going to bail me out, huh? Okay, it's me again, you know, and you just kind of like reach inside.
Erin Graybill, welcome to Fearless Sellers, the Women of Amazon podcast. Let's dive into the heart of innovation, resilience, and success in the e-commerce world. Erin is the visionary founder of a recognized beauty brand that's defining the beauty industry with its cruelty-free, sensitive skin-friendly makeup brushes. From Erin's beginning as a research student to receiving an offer from Amazon to buy her brand, Erin's journey is nothing short of inspirational. So y'all buckle up as we explore the challenges and triumphs of building a beauty empire, scaling beyond the first million, and the power of pushing past perfection to achieve greatness. Erin, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored and excited to be here.
Let's talk about how you were a research student in economics, and then you started this amazing beauty brand that grew past seven figures. Can you share this with us?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a funny story because I never imagined that I would be in the physical products business, but now that I'm here, I'm like, it's what I was supposed to do. So rewind back to the end of 2014, and I was an economics student in England, northeastern England, and I got a scholarship, and I was actually complaining to one of my best friends that I was like, oh, I just wish I made more money. Being a student's okay, but like, I want to make more money. And she just kind of looks at me and she's like, why don't you make more money then? I was like, oh, dang it. You know, I was like, what do I do? And so my relationship at the time, he had started selling Amazon like a year earlier. And he's like, I really think you would like this. And I just walked into his office and I'm like, I'm ready to learn. So I didn't really get any formal training, but I actually started, as much as I'm so passionate about beauty products and all the things that you can create, I very much started as an economist by going through browse nodes and using the 999 method. I don't know if any of like my old school sellers out there know, because in the UK, this is before Jungle Scout. So you actually went through and figured out how much products were selling just by saying, you know, I want to buy 999. You add to the cart. Amazon says how much are available in FBA. Then you go back the next day. So there's, if you know, you know, with the 999. So that's when I first started. And I found two opportunities, one in makeup brushes and one in men's wallets. So my interest, the beauty brand, kind of came off the back of getting into that and not just wanting to find a profitable niche, but really make outstanding products. So I became absolutely obsessed with product design, and Nirei Beauty is now, it's a brand that's still with my company to this day. It's our most profitable brand still. So yeah, that's how it started.
That's awesome.
But yeah, it started up kind of like, want to make more money. Everyone's doing this Amazon thing. But then really what hooked me onto it, it wasn't just the opportunity to make money. It was really wanting to exceed customer expectations. And that's been at the heart of everything that we've done. I say we now. It was me then.
And how big's your team now?
There's about seven of us, including like part-time BAs, et cetera. So a little bit smaller. Now we're going more virtual, but passionate. We're very passionate.
Do you ever look back and you're like, what if I had picked men's wallets?
Yeah, well, I mean, I did in the beginning. Sold them for a couple years. So we definitely had both of them. But it's interesting that I feel that both of them probably could have grown to about the same amount of effort. But that's where it's like, I've heard you say before, when you're picking something that you want to sell, you encourage people, especially women, pick something you're passionate about. And that was a perfect opportunity. We were really big about customer service. And with the wallets, actually, we ended up getting so much feedback about an inner pocket, how we can make it better. And I just never prioritized it. where with the makeup brushes, I was giving samples to estheticians, makeup artists constantly asking how I could make it better. So the empathy part of it, of a product I would want to use, definitely is probably why the wallets aren't there anymore, because I wasn't keeping pace. Passion really makes a difference.
You could have met a lot of men, though, if you're like, hey, check out this wallet.
Yeah, I know that's true. I missed out. I always wonder, though. I was like, I wonder if, you know, you'll ever be like at a conference or at a restaurant somewhere, like, because we sold like probably 5,000, 6,000, you know, they're still out there. Luso of London wallets. I actually used the brand. I revived it recently to sell men's candles. So it's, the brand is still alive and kicking. It's just not really with the wallets, but yeah. That's where it began.
It is fun when you see people using your products. I've been out before, and I see products from the first brand that I grew from zero to a million quickly. And I see those products a lot of places, like people using them, and it just warms my heart. I'm like, oh, look, I built that. Not that I go and say anything. I just am like, oh, wow.
What kind of products are they? I love hearing this stuff.
Yeah. So my first brand was Outdoor Sports. And I launched it in late 2020, early 2021 during COVID, and outdoor sports seemed, well, especially living in Austin, everything is outside. So I actually had 16 products in the line, but only like two, three of the products like got me past the million mark. And then I sold it. And interesting, the brand that bought it doesn't want me saying what the exact product is.
Okay.
You know, there's all those like intricacies when after you sell, but I can say Outdoor Sports. And really it was just outdoor sports line. Like even the name of it is an outdoor sports line. It's not a household name at all. It's still in seven figures. It hasn't hit eight yet. I exited that one in 2022, and now I sell women's products. So I sell like some lotions and some other like women's health geared towards older women, which, as we were talking about, is a bit more passion driven. So let's talk about, you said something key in there, that you were giving samples to makeup artists and estheticians to help get feedback to, was that to improve your product or get them to recommend your product?
In the beginning, it was to improve 100%. So I ended up ordering, I think my first batch was super small. It was like under 500 units, and I sold them all in a month. And then it was at that point that I was talking to someone, a guy that was in the industry too. And he's like, great, you sold them, order more. And at that moment, I was like, I just don't know if they're good enough. 2014 was a lot easier to sell things. So I was selling them profitably. And I was saying, oh, professional grade. I was saying all these things or writing my own bullets. But inside, I didn't actually know, because like, I am not a makeup artist. I mean, I had a few like dusty old makeup brushes. I'm embarrassed to say that at the time. And so it was just really important to me that they were as good as possible. And I was like, well, I kept 10 of them aside. That I didn't, because this is when I was like stickering them from my living room quality control, sending them to FBA in the UK, and I kept 10. And so that's what I did. I went to makeup artists and estheticians, some that I knew because I'd been living in England for a few years at that point. And I was like, and it was a beautiful looking makeup brush set. But I didn't do anything. It was out of the catalog basically. And so I was like, I'd love to give you this makeup brush set on one condition. And most of them, they were like, what? I was like, tell me what you don't like. And they were like, oh, that's a bit rude. Like, why would, I was like, no, because what you like doesn't do me any favors. Tell me what would make you not use this. What would make you complain? What could be better? And I promise you, if you tell me, I'll do it. And then I did. And so I kept making it better and better and became a bit obsessed. I had a brilliant makeup artist that I found on Pinterest that I still stay in touch with in Australia. So I was sending samples back to her. We were looking at everything. I had calipers out to really figure out the components of a beautiful makeup brush. So one of our top selling makeup brushes, the Artistry set, is really a version of that very first one from December 2014. It's just probably had like 12 different iterations. And at some point you just have to stop, because then you know, it's amazing feedback, but then you realize makeup artists, they're artists, and every single one is going to see things a bit differently. So then it did evolve where we actually supplied makeup brushes to loads of amazing makeup artists across the UK and Europe. So we've got footage of Nire brushes in Paris and Milan and London, and seeing people from all over Europe using the Nire brushes. And then we actually did some B2B in Scandinavia. So that's what we've sold a lot more outside of the US than in the US. And that's all part of the journey. It's been really fun.
That is exciting. Okay, we'll touch on expanding from the UK to the US in a second, but wait, let's go back. So when you were doing all of these improvements and phases, how expensive was that? Like, I'm just hearing going back and then fixing my product, changing. Like, how did you balance the cost of doing this?
It wasn't actually as expensive as you would think, because every order would be one iteration. Like, I actually was one of the first ones. I was the first one in the makeup brush game, actually, in Amazon to bundle with a brush cleaning tool and a sponge. So it started with the brush cleaning tool. And it's also, I think, as female sellers, and I'm going to make some positive stereotypes about females, is that we are empathetic. We have great intuition. Not to mention that there was an amazing stat about 80% of household customer buying decisions are done by women. That's for everyone. So not only do we do the shopping, we know what we want and we know what it would take to be better. So that's kind of what happened. I was like, people are buying this tool, they're buying this. So I would look at the margins and see, could I incorporate these extra accessories that would be the next logical choice that also wouldn't be as profitable to sell alone as at Amazon and build more of a moat. So first it was a cleaning tool, and then that went into, well, include a guide of the first thing you should do is wash your brushes and just think how to get ahead with more value. Then I added the sponge. So they would be little increments, you know, like there's like I have all the different boxes at our headquarters in London from like different packaging, different, it's like the evolution. So each time would be a small iteration. We never, and really like one of my mantras that I've had to like, I actually had it on a sticky note for 2 years on my computer that says perfection is the enemy of done. So sometimes you can just make one iteration. You just do it, because even though you know you could make it 10 times better, you have to simplify your improvement process to also make sure it's profitable as well. So it's always been kind of a balance of seeing exceeding expectations, creating new expectations, but also making sure that you're not over-delivering on profitability too. So you got to balance the two. So that's how we've done it with Nire. And then our off Amazon sales, when we did a lot of high volume B2B across Scandinavia, we could sell the individual tools because we could sell 2,000, 100,000, 200,000 at once. We're on Amazon. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of technical specification within the brand of Nire that isn't just on Amazon, because the distribution channel has to be the right fit for the type of profitability for each product.
Yes, that makes sense. So let's talk along those lines of expansion. Let's talk about first, you launched in the UK, and then how did you decide to go into the US next? I'm assuming you went US next. And what were your challenges?
I went Europe next, actually.
Europe. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So that was, so there was actually challenges there too. So this was before, when was this? 2016. So actually I didn't go into hit the 7-figure mark and built ourselves up as a company before even going to the US. It's actually a lot harder. I didn't realize this. So we started in the UK and then expanded. In my experience with my products, it's harder in the UK and Europe. Because not only do you have to pay VAT, so there's more downward pressure on the margin, is there's less keyword depth. And so a lot of times we would be launching things within beauty on short tail keywords in 5 different languages against Chinese sellers. So it was really, really, it was tough, but then it actually really helped us as a company, because if you could make it there, you have a bit more resilience and a bit more, you're used to having to be as efficient as possible because you don't really have that margin for error. So it was great. And we were doing the B2B too. So it was VAT registered in so many different countries. So it was kind of like then going to the US and Canada, where we're like, oh, some people take, you know, the, I think, is it called VAT, whatever the tax registration is in Canada.
Yes, it is that. Yeah.
There's like a barrier to entry. But I was like, oh, what's another country? Because we were kind of used to that already. So that was the first thing. And then brought the brands Nire and then a gift box brand to the US in March 2021. So that's when the whole US thing happened. And the biggest difference was that was, oh my goodness, the long tails. Wow. Keywords in the US. I tell you what, there's beautiful keyword depth and a lot more competition. But yeah, so that was, it's different skill sets for different markets.
And what are the price points? As we're talking about conserving your margin, what were your price points and have they changed over the years?
Well, we haven't been able to raise them the last couple of years, but right now, on average for our sets, it's around like $50 in the US and 40, 45 euros, pounds-ish, depending on markets, because we do deliver like a higher end bundle. Where in, I say the real world, like if this was in Sephora or something, I was like, oh, the quality, they should be double that. But you know what Amazon's like. You got to make sure you're at the right price point to move enough of the products. So having the review moat has been really helpful to justify those prices. Launching from scratch within beauty tools would be quite difficult. But we arrived in the US with 6,000 reviews at the time, 4.8 out of 5. So we were ready to go.
Smart. So what I'm hearing is you did everything you could in the UK and Europe, and you had passed your goals. Let's just say that you hit your goals for those markets. And then you said, okay, now I am ready to take on North America.
Yeah. And I was actually really nervous to sell in the US because I was, accent aside, I'm a dual citizen. So I was very established in the UK. So that's why it was very natural for me to start in the UK and Europe. Like my company is a limited company, not an LLC, like all those types of things. So it seems a bit backwards because of the way I sound, but actually I spent 15 years like being like, I don't know, rooted in the UK. So that's why it made more sense. But I was actually quite afraid of selling in the US because I was like the competition. I feel like, you know, all of my people I would meet at like masterminds and stuff, people are always getting like sued and hijacked and extorted. And I was like, oh no, I don't want to do that. So when we first started, I launched a new gift box brand as well, which was like wildly successful right out of the gates. But then I did experience all those things, extorted, hijacked, duped, copyrights, like all the things. But with that, you also, there's just a bigger piece of revenue that everyone's competing for. So it's all relative, but definitely black hat, those types of things. I feel it in the US where, I know there's exceptions, but the UK and Europe, you didn't have as much as that. But you also don't have as many customers or keywords. So pick your poison.
Right. Exactly. And like, as you grow any business on Amazon, off Amazon, there's just more problems, right? You're growing bigger, more problems. People take notice of you. Yes. So
it's the curse sometimes of being on page one in some niches. I'm like, oh, no, never again, man. Keep me on page two.
It's like, congratulations for all your problems. People felt that way when I would say I would have inventory challenges. Mm-hmm. And I would get close to running out of inventory. People would always be like, oh, poor you. I'm like, well, yeah. I mean, it comes with the challenge of growing quickly and copycats and people taking notes. So
it is like you run out of inventory, but then, you know, every day you're out of inventory, other people are converting on your keywords. Like there is no, it is wrong to stay still. So I would have given you the empathy. Don't you worry. I feel your
pain. Thank you. Yes. I went back and looked, and I think I cost the company like, I don't know, $70,000-$80,000 in revenue for how many times I ran out of inventory. But those are growing pains that happen your first couple years of selling. And that's the beauty of running your own business. You just push through and resilience comes in. Let's talk about, it sounds like you have pushed through and been resilient in all of your expansion as well, because you've expanded off of Amazon. Tell me some of the challenges with that.
Yeah, the challenges, I would say, since we haven't done a lot on like direct to the website. We've done some, but we haven't put a lot of budget into it. It's just been off the back of people learning about the brand, wanting to buy things just direct from us. But we ended up doing some off Amazon, kind of bigger contracts across Northern Europe, because I did, as being a British company, we got to go on trade missions, the government funded. So we would go to other countries and meet buyers. So there were some online retail beauty boxes, those types of things that we would do bespoke beauty tools for. And if it wasn't for the face-to-face meetings that were facilitated by the UK Department of Trade, it wouldn't have happened. So it just took, like, I guess having the background a bit, like a hustle background, you know, of coming to the country and stuff, any opportunity for government help. With my American background, I was like, wow, I didn't think that happened with business. Like, you know, like I can get a trade advisor. I can, you know, so I basically was like, any opportunity to go on a trade mission, I don't care if I literally just like help you guys carry your materials, like to have the opportunity to sit in front of a buyer. And I actually got that opportunity in 2018. And it ended up expanding to other things. There's B2B is a whole nother beast also too. Mm-hmm. Different types of negotiation, different payment terms. You know, the good thing about selling on Amazon, okay, people are like, you know, you have to wait 2 weeks for those disbursements. Well, what about net 90, waiting 9 days, you know, before you get paid anything? And what if that company goes under also, you know, like there's no, so it's like, it's amazing when it works out, but it's like anything in business, the grass is always greener also to be like, oh, that'll be easier. Like that'll be where it really is. I guess the more legs you can have on the stool, the better. My company, because we were doing so much European export, we were affected quite heavily by Brexit, like ridiculously. That's one of the reasons I came to, and I don't know, like to, I'm an economics geek, so I can just stop myself before I start. But it was huge for importers and exporters like my company in the UK. That's one of the reasons I chose to expand to the US because of the way Brexit was done. I'll save that ranting about that, is that it was easier as a British company for us to export to America than it was to Europe, where before Europe was like cross-state trade equivalent, you know, it was like free trade across the markets. And then it became, we couldn't sell for 6 months. The supply chain was backed up. So that summer is when I kind of realized, like the trade economist in me was like, wait a second. Okay, 90-day lead time. Don't know what's going to happen with Europe. Like, oh crap, I can't launch anything in Europe. I was like, time for America. So that's when I came up with a gift box brand and a UK only brand, which would kind of help navigate not only customer behaviors after COVID, but to go with the supply chain that we had. So that was how, like, that's also how America happened as well, was just kind of like the whole geoeconomic thing. So it affected our European website sales. And then when the Ukrainian crisis happened, there was a credit, like a cost of living crisis in the UK and even more heavily in Europe. And again, I don't know how much your audience follows these types of things, but electricity and gas was like 2-3x. And it's so a lot of mortgage rates went up. So cost of living really, really hurts, got hit. I sell the types of products that you like to have, but you don't need to have. So then we had to then put more focus into the US. So I feel like it's this constant like geopolitical dance of between all the different markets of having to pivot, start brands, stop them. So yeah, that's kind of where we are. We don't do as much B2B now because a lot of those companies just don't order anymore because they've lost so many customers because people don't have as much money to spend on nice to haves, luxurious beauty boxes, those types of things.
I mean, Erin, that's quite a resilient story. And you just kept plugging away and shifting and being innovative. Why keep going? Was there a point where you were like, you know what? I could just go back to economics and be a professor. I'm making that up, but like, was there a moment or a few moments?
I think I'm just such an entrepreneur. I always have, but like being a professor was never going to work. It's never going to work for me. It's a whole another long story. So I think that's kind of like one of those things. I feel like some people choose entrepreneurship, but it's like, it is just who I am. So you get knocked down. What do? You find another way. Like I might have like a few weeks where I'm like feeling super sorry for myself. Okay. I go through all the things. That's when I had to figure out before pivoting those two brands, I was like going on these walks and just kind of being like, I'm screwed. Okay. Then I'm like, then it was just, you kind of like hit that reality of like, what am I going to do? I can't launch any more things in Europe. And then it's just kind of like, it's just kind of that process of hitting that rock bottom and then realizing, well, no one's going to bail me out, huh? Okay, it's me again, you know, and you just kind of like reach inside. And it's similar, our top gift box brand, we're now liquidating. it's no secret. I mean, there's like outlet deals left and right. And that was like our biggest growing brand. So I'm actually going like a few months ago going through that same thing. And now I have a new brand that I'm formulating behind the scenes as well. And I just think that's part of what happens, where sometimes you become a victim of your own success. When things go too well, you take your eye off the ball and you get lazy sometimes. Like I know in 2023 was a really rough year. I know for a lot of people, for me personally, I think I should have done a lot better. And I think there was like a few really cozy, profitable years that made me a bit soft to business, because you always got to be thinking of what's next. You always have to. Good times, it's all cyclical, right? You know, so that's just like, I'm building it up again, and it'll probably go down again. It's just some lessons as far as continuing to be conservative with cash flow. I have some amazing directors on my team in the UK that I really was like a sponge to their suggestions when things were really good and really profitable. Instead, like 2021 and 2022, we kept cash in the business. What business does that? Like, you should scale everything. But at the same time, we were able to weather a really, really unfortunate storm of last year because of being conservative when times are really good. So it's kind of like every year there's more lessons, but that's one. If you ever have FOMO, which I do, you know, it's like, why aren't you scaling harder? Why aren't you going bigger? Where it's like, okay, like cheesy little quote is, that I also have to tell myself when I'm feeling like, oh, maybe I'm not aggressive enough, is that more businesses die of indigestion than starvation. You know, growing too fast, doing like, I'm not trying to say you shouldn't go big, but if like over the last couple of years, if we wouldn't have taken a more conservative approach with maintaining some cash, I might have had to close the business. Instead, we had the funds to rebuild and keep going.
Yeah. And forecasting comes into play, especially if you were doing the B2B and you're not collecting money for 60 to 90 days. And yeah, I spent a lot of time forecasting my inventory spend, because I always would get that anxiety feeling when I would have to write the big checks for inventory to keep it going. And I don't know, it was like, I know I had to get used to it, and I would tell myself, get used to this, but I knew in like 4 months, I'm going to have to write this check. And I was like, I'm going to forecast. And that actually probably what saved my business was not overspending on my inventory. Even though sometimes I ran out, I still couldn't just like put, you know, $100,000 into inventory. I had to.
Oh, no, I would definitely suggest to anyone that's listening, that's one of the mistakes that we made at the end of 2022. Or going into Christmas of 2022, is we still have stock that we're trying to get rid of. So now we're like forecasting long-term storage fees. And there's like the type of forecasting you have to do to kind of back yourself out of being like, what's the cost of a liquidation versus outlet deal versus all those types of things. So definitely, like, that's, if it makes anyone feel better about like running out of stock, the flip side of that is way too much stock is a whole nother amount of problems with how Amazon is making it more vital that you are on the ball with inventory. You have too much, you have too little, you're going to get charged. So it's like, it's tough. It just makes you're going to have to, I guess, really deepen your relationship with your spreadsheets, or make sure someone on your team.
Yes. Get those relationships going with your spreadsheets. I love it. That is like real advice.
But it's true. It'll save you.
All right, let's talk about something super fun. And I really don't know what this is, but I know that you won the Queen's Award for Enterprise. What is this?
Yeah, that's something, especially as like with my American roots, it was like mind blowing. So there's actually an award every year that businesses can apply for in a few different categories that the Queen of England actually approves, and you win an award from the Queen of England. So that's like such like a pinch myself moment. So we won it in 2021 under the category of export. So there was a few different reasons that we won it. So as a British firm, because we sold so much in Europe and then the US, that was all export. And I've always hired a bunch of diverse interns from every different country. We work with a charity that packs one of our brands. So there's a lot of things that we did as a company. And I say I was like, I have an amazing team that helped bring this. My team are really my superpower. So it was what we were doing because of the values that we wanted as a company, that when we had the opportunity to apply, I didn't even know it existed, honestly. And then our PR person's like, let's do it. And then when we won, I was like, no way. So I got to go to Windsor Castle. It was the queen was unwell at the time. So it was a few different royals that were kind of like networking around. So it was like, oh my goodness. When I was just like a freaking side hustler student, for one, I never even thought I'd have a team, then end up growing the most amazing, passionate team that created so much. I feel like, say it again, they were absolutely my superpower, that put the company forward for an award that ended up being at Windsor Castle. I'm like, what the heck? So that's something we're really proud of. And it does inspire us still to try to build our UK-based brand that supports a charity, a few different charities actually based in the UK.
I love it. That is super, super impressive and so fancy. And I do love that you have the charity backed. Before we say goodbye, can you tell me something that you are just so excited about for 2024? Like, what is just making you wake up in the morning and continue pushing forward?
Oh, it's actually some of the new brands, my new secret brand that I'm working on, because I've been passionate about every single brand and every single product. But this is the first time I'm actually working to formulate things that are super unique with different types of ingredients and based in the US. So that's something that I've never been able to do. So again, all my brands and my products feel like my baby, but I think to be able to bring some things into the world this year in a way where I can more easily visit the factories now that I'm based here in Miami. So yeah, it'll make more sense once it launches, but I'm super, super excited.
Well, best of luck. We know it'll be successful and I can't wait. And we will definitely have to have you back on the Fearless Sellers podcast. It has been an absolute pleasure to host you today. Erin, until next time, stay fearless.
If you're already selling on Amazon or you're looking to get started and you want my help, go to amzfearless.com to book a free strategy selling session. We can see if we can help you out. That's amzfearless.com. Talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the Fearless Sellers, the Women of Amazon podcast. Until next time, stay fearless.